This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, my guest will be Michael Hughes, a regular participant on Where Did the Road Go? And also a bit of an expert on the tarot. So we're going to be discussing the tarot with him tonight. There is an extra segment for Patreons I'll put up later in the week. And as of last night, well, last night from the initial airing of this, Black Friday, technically. Let's go with that. As of Black Friday, we put up our first Fringe News episode. Hopefully, we will do these somewhat regularly. If you'd like to contribute news stories for us to talk about, you can upload them or post them to the Where Did the Road Go Facebook page, the group, I should say, not the page, the group. And that way it's shared there, and we'll go over them. And when we have time, we'll do a Fringe News episode where we discuss some of those stories. So you can check that out at the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. Other than that, as I've said before, there's a new t-shirt design and a bunch of great stuff on the site. Just go to the site, take a look around. I did an episode of Nox Mente earlier this week, and I posted that immediately. It was all about dreams and stuff. It was a really interesting show. I really enjoyed being on it. And that is also up, and you can find them on YouTube as well. And there's a second part that once they put up, I'll be sharing as well. All right. Without any further ado, here's my conversation with Michael Hughes. All right, so I am here with Mr. Mike Hughes. It's been a while since you've been on the show in any way, shape, or form, Mike.
Yeah, I've missed it. It's always a great pleasure to be on your show, and I miss the roundtables. I hope to jump back in again. My life's been a little bit hectic with moving and other assorted stuff, but I miss the gang. So I'm happy to be here tonight.
We almost had you a couple times for roundtables, and then just didn't quite work.
Nope. Had to kick some. I had kids in my podcast space, so that always makes it a little difficult to focus and have a conversation.
You can just include them,
right? Them yelling and beating each other in the background. Yeah, that would be entertaining.
All right, so we're gonna talk about tarot, which is something you have studied in great depth, and I have not. I mean, I've always been a little bit interested in tarot, mm-hmm. but I didn't know how little I knew about it until I saw your presentation at Fort Fest last year.
Yeah, that was a fun. I kind of condensed my usual 6-hour class down into an hour. So I covered a lot of territory, but it was a lot of fun.
So do you do classes on tarot?
I do. I teach classes. I teach classes on my own. I've taught through the Johns Hopkins University Odyssey program. It's like a non-credit advanced academic program. And I teach people privately and things like that too, if they ask. But it's really fun. It's something I started doing about 6 or 7 years ago, and it's amazing. I mean, it was the popularity of tarot and the way it's just kind of caught fire in the past, you know, I guess less than a decade. I've seen just the phenomenal increase in the number of people interested. And luckily that coincided with me teaching. And whereas I started with maybe, you know, a dozen people in the class, the last one that I taught at Johns Hopkins, they had to put me in the largest room on that part of campus, because it just more and more people kept signing up, and they kept saying, can you take more people? Sure, yeah, you know, throw some more in. So it's really been impressive to see this growing interest. And I have a lot of thoughts on why it's becoming popular. You know, we could certainly get into that tonight too.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Why do you think it's growing popularity?
Well, you know, I think there's a general resurgence of interest, whether it's cyclical or not, whether it's, you know, it happens every, you know, whether we're sort of in the same cycle that you know, the 60s and the 70s was the precursor to, I'm not really sure, but there's a definite interest, as you know, from your listeners and other podcasts, there's an enormous growth of interest in the occult, in you know, the supernatural, the esoteric, things like that. And you know, I see it in Freemasonry. You know, I'm in a lodge in Maryland, and I've seen, you know, an increase in guys coming into Freemasonry because they're interested in, like, the esoteric stuff, not necessarily just, you know, being in a club. Mm. So it really feels like culturally, and, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, an interest in witchcraft and things like that. Some of the other stuff I'm involved in, and magic in general. So there's really just this culture. It's part of the zeitgeist right now that this stuff is taking off in popularity. I mean, you know, my literary agent, he's, you know, he was telling me that, you know, his daughter shops at, you know, Urban Outfitters or something like that. And he's like, man, you know, the tables there, they have like tarot decks and books on witchcraft and stuff like that, you know, and these are tweens and teens that are getting into this stuff. So it really, it just feels like it's out there now. It's really happening. The other thing I think is people are sort of pushing away from all this screen time that dominates so much of our lives, and getting a tarot reading or reading for someone, or even just reading for yourself and working with the cards, you know, it's an analog experience. And even better when you're giving someone a reading or someone's reading for you, you're having a conversation with somebody. You're not sitting there staring at your phones at a restaurant or something like that. And so when people take my classes and they start reading for people, you know, a couple of them have said that about how, you know, how excited they are to be having conversations with people about things in their lives, and just engaging with other humans is becoming so rare for so many people nowadays that, you know, it's a way of getting together with other people, talking, telling stories, telling things about yourself, or listening to things about other people. So I think that's a big part of it too.
Hmm. Okay. I've always kind of done readings on myself. I've never been all that much for reading other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and some people will say, oh, you can't read for yourself. Yeah, and I think that's absurd. Of course you can read for yourself. I mean, how do you learn, and how do you learn about yourself, and how do you learn about, you know, how you fool yourself? Because when you're putting out a card, when you're asking a question, or you're trying to get at the heart of some problem or some issue, and you put some cards out, your natural instinct is to look for what you want in those cards. Mm-hmm. And the best thing about reading for yourself is if you do it long enough, you start to learn how you want to fool yourself. You start to see how your brain starts putting patterns together the way you want to see them. And what reading for yourself can do is it can teach you objectivity, and it could teach you to sort of, you know, transcend your ego a little bit and just try to see different, you know, it teaches you different ways of thinking, and it also teaches you how you fool yourself. And we all love to fool ourselves. We all love to, you know, paint the bright picture. And sometimes the cards might be saying, hey, this, you know, you're screwed up. This is not a good idea. Maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Maybe there's a way out of this situation that you're not thinking of, and so forth. So I think, you know, there's all kinds of ridiculous myths about the cards. Like, you can't buy your first deck. You have to be gifted your deck. I don't know where that came from, but I hear that popping up all the time. Like, of course you can buy your deck. I mean, there's just all sorts of silliness about these cards, and I try to combat a lot of that silliness. And I think the way I do it, and the way I suggest other people, if they're interested, is to first learn about the history, because when you learn the history, and you learn the real history and not the nonsensical history, that structures the way you understand the cards and the way you read the cards. So in my classes, that's the first thing we look at, is where did these cards come from? How did they become what they are today? What are the myths that people have been repeating over and over? The myths that were told to me when I was first getting into this stuff and reading books and all that. So it's I say the key to you can't understand the tarot until you understand the history.
Okay, well, let's get into a little of the history, because I think most people believe it has some kind of mystical, sacred history, and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I run up against that constantly. These cards originated as a game. They were made for playing a game. The history is very clear about that. In the middle of the 15th century or so, and because playing cards already existed, playing cards were first referenced in Europe around the year 1370 or so, the first references to cards. And these cards actually came, playing cards came from China, because China was the first place that paper was invented. So, and interestingly, the Chinese, the cards were also four suits. That's one thing you find running from the very first cards in China all the way up to our modern playing cards, is the idea of four suits, you know, never five, never six. Mm-hmm. So that's remained pretty constant. But the first playing cards, they came out of China. Then they were taken up in the Arab world. In Egypt, there's a deck that's still preserved, or some cards from a deck. It's called the Mamluk deck, and that deck had had four suits as well. And interestingly, those cards, the suits in those cards were scimitars, which is like a curved Asian sword, coins, polo sticks, and cups. And if you look at modern tarot cards, we have swords, coins, sticks, and cups. Mm-hmm. So there's a remarkable continuity going all the way back to like the 13th, 14th century Egypt. So these cards started circulating in Europe. And you can watch as they make their way through southern Europe, through northern Europe. And because the Europeans didn't play polo, they took those polo sticks and they changed them to wands or staves or whatever they wanted to call them. And the scimitars, they did keep the curved swords. So in the early European tarot decks, the swords are curved, like scimitars. So really people were playing cards for a long time before the tarot came around. And the earliest tarot cards that we found are around the early to the middle of the 15th century, so like around 1420 to 1440, something like that. And the difference between tarot cards is they added another suit, and these were called trumps. And the trumps are like what they now call the major arcana, or the major cards. Those are the ones you see when you're watching a movie and there's, you know, a voodoo priestess, you know, putting down cards like the death card, or the hanged man, or the lovers, that sort of thing.
Right.
And so those were added around the somewhere around 1420 to 1440 or so. And these cards were all hand painted at the time. And we pretty much have a really good idea about why those cards exist, why there's the Fool, why there's, you know, why there's the Lovers, why there's the Sun card, why there's the Emperor and the Empress and things like that. And that's because there was a really famous poem by Petrarch, which was called essentially it was about these parades. There were parades in northern Italy, and they were called triumph parades. And what they were basically like Mardi Gras or something. They were giant floats that people would spend enormous amounts of money. The Duke or the King, they would spend enormous amounts of money and resources on these parades that would roll through town. And these parades, these floats, had things like death, the Lovers. They had things like, let me see. Basically, the poem itself was called The Triumph of Love, Chastity, and Death. And you can look this up if you look up Petrarch. Il Triomfi is the actual name of the poem. And you've got floats that are love, temperance, fortune, the Pope, the Emperor, the Empress, death, the devil, the wheel of fortune, the sun and the moon, and all this are all part of this parade. It was matched up to that Petrarch poem. It was kind of like the Star Wars of its day. Like, everybody knew this poem. And the way it worked is it starts off with, it builds. So first you get love and temperance and fortune, then you get the Pope and the Emperor. So as each float goes by, it becomes, the subject becomes more powerful until you end with like things like the sun and the moon and the world. Mm. So you've got this structure to these parades that are very much the same structure and the same elements and the same iconography that we see in the tarot. So we've got a pretty very clear precursor to where this imagery came from. And it's also Christian imagery, which shocks a lot of people, because nowadays the tarot is associated with, you know, paganism and witchcraft and things like that. But it came from Christian Europe. And its iconography, the early decks, were purely Christian. I mean, they had a pope in the cards. Right. If you look at that card now, what it's become is the high priest. Mm. But it wasn't the high priest. It was the pope. And all the iconography in the cards, I mean, there's the resurrection. There's people, you know, the judgment card, people rising from their graves with the angel blowing the horn. All of it is taken from, if you showed the cards of the time to the people of the time, it was clearly all Christian, because, you know, Europe was just it was a Christian country, and it was enforced, you know. So that blows a lot of people's minds, because they associate the tarot with all sorts of things that are, you know, explicitly not Christian. So, right. You know, that's something that I bring up. So the earliest decks, but then at the same time, you know, this is the Middle Ages, into the Renaissance when the tarot begins to take off. So in the Renaissance, you know, a lot of courtly people, wealthy people who could afford to, were studying, the ancient Greeks and things like that. So you do get elements of paganism being incorporated and mixing with that Christian imagery as well. So there's a deck called the Mantegna deck that has, you know, it has Greek and Roman gods in it, and very hermetic sort of content. So you do get this sort of, because as Europe is starting to fall in love in the Renaissance with pagan ideas and pagan concepts, you do start to see that and some of the decks, but the standard tarot deck has pretty much until, esotericists, French esotericists got their hands on it, was understood as a deck of cards that you played a game with. And it had power. I mean, these images are powerful, really. You know, I mean, when you've got a card with a devil on it, and some of the early decks, you know, the devil is like just, it's just such an arresting, powerful image. Or when you have the death card, so these images were powerful, and they undoubtedly affected people and made them think about what these cards were. And even going back to the 15th century or so, there are mentions of the cards being used in other ways than game playing. Sometimes like someone would be given a card and that was supposed to sort of indicate their personality or something like that. There's evidence that these cards were used. There's some in Italy, there's in the records of the Inquisition, there are stories of people using especially the devil card for casting spells and things like that. So there are glimmerings of sort of an occult usage of the cards, but for the most part, it was just for playing a game. And it was a game where you played with money. So that's the reason the church didn't really like it, because you're not supposed to, trivially, gamble your money away. You're supposed to give it to the church if you have any extra money. So there's, it's a record of the Roman Catholic Church, saying, how horrible the tarot is. But it's not because it was anything occult, really. It's just that people, you're supposed to be coming to church, and if you have extra money, you put it, when they pass the hat around or the basket around, you throw the money in there. Gambling is bad, so don't play this game. It's not like they considered the cards, demonic or evil or dangerous or anything like that.
What kind of game was played with them?
Yeah, it's a game that's kind of like bridge. So it's like a trick-taking game. I don't play bridge. I tried playing tarot with this app. And if anybody's interested, you can find apps where you can play Tarocchi, which is the Italian way, the name of the game in Italian, and it's still played in parts of Europe, this game. But it's like a betting game where it's like a trick-taking game along the lines of bridge or something like that. But it's kind of complicated. It was hard for me even with this app to wrap my head around it. But it was very popular. Incredibly popular. It spread through, it spread to France. But all in all, people were having fun. They were taking these cards, they were playing, and mostly it was wealthy people, because, your average dirt, farmer peasant, didn't have time to sit around, and they didn't have any money to bet. So this was mostly in the wealthy courts of Ferrara and things like that in Florence.
How do we know the app is accurate to what used to be played as tarot?
Well, there probably have been some changes as it's gone through time, but I think it's pretty, historians, there are historians that study playing cards and who study, tarot, and they would say that the game is probably pretty similar to the way it was played back then. I don't know I'm not 100% sure if there are any rule books from the era or anything like that, but we do see there are paintings of people playing and things like that. Mm. And it's, games do mutate and change, and also I'm sure it's not exactly the way it was played, but it is a tradition. It's a traditional game, and it has been being played for hundreds of years. So it's probably fairly similar.
So how did it transition from a game to a fortune-telling tool?
Yeah, well, that's where the story gets kind of fascinating. Like I said, there were some indications that the cards were used for divination. There's an Italian sonnet from, 1527 that talks about taking a card, and it has a little verse in the sonnet that sort of is a fortune, kind of like a fortune cookie kind of thing. But it really wasn't until many hundreds of years later, in the middle of the 18th century, around 1750 or so, that these French esoteric Freemasons got their hands on the cards. And one of the first was a guy called Antoine Court de Gebelin. And he was a he was actually a pastor. He was a Protestant pastor. He was also a Freemason and a Martinist, and Martinism is kind of an esoteric offshoot of Freemasonry. So he was, you know, and we have to remember at this period of time, in the middle of the 18th century, esotericism was like huge, especially among like the educated, wealthy classes in France. So Court de Gebelin, he said he saw a countess playing a card game. He saw a countess playing tarot, you know, he saw her playing the game. And he looks at it and he's blown away, because he sees these cards and he says, well, there's such incredible symbolism on these cards. So he says, well, they had to have come from ancient Egypt. Why did he say this? Well, because of the rage in esotericism. This was also the time when, this was before the Rosetta Stone was deciphered. So, but there was a lot of interest in Egypt and hieroglyphics, but no one really knew what they meant yet.
Right.
So there was, they called it Egyptomania, was kind of sweeping through these esoteric circles at the time. And you know, they were all sorts of, you know, wild ideas of what these hieroglyphics meant. So Court de Gebelin is the first to say, well, that these cards clearly had to come from Egypt. And with really zero evidence that there's any Egyptian content in these cards, he goes and writes a book. And he says the cards have come from ancient Egypt. He was also the first. Now, he noticed an interesting coincidence, and in that there are 22 tarot trump cards. There are 22 of those major cards. He says, well, there's also 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So he says, well, that's, then obviously these cards not only came from Egypt, because I said so, but that each card has an equivalent in the Hebrew alphabet. So so he's out there pushing this stuff, and people are eating it up. And then another French mystic occultist guy comes along, and his name was Jean-Baptiste Alliet, but he changed his basically inverted his last name, Alliet, so it became Atea. And that's that was his pen name. So he had already written a book about playing card divination, because by this point in time, people were telling fortunes with regular old playing cards. And then he sees one of his teachers tells him about the tarot, and she says, this is his story at least, this is the key to all the secret wisdom of the ancients, right? These cards. So he goes and writes, he's also reading de Gebelin's theories. So he kind of rolls that into his, and he says that the tarot is actually the ancient Egyptian book of Thoth. And Thoth is basically the Hermes Trismegistus, okay, who is basically Thoth and Mercury and Hermes all rolled into one, the great teacher of wisdom. And he says this book of Thoth, these tarot cards, it was actually engraved on gold by priests after the great flood, and they were put up inside the pyramid so that when initiates were brought into the pyramid, they were led by these essentially gold plate tarot cards. And that's how they were taught the wisdom of the ages. So Atea publishes his book, and that starts taking off. And everybody just starts accepting this. And even today, you know, I mean, you go talk to people who read cards and they'll say, oh yeah, this is ancient Egyptian wisdom, and it got passed down by the gypsies who brought it, you know, with them and to Europe and all this kind of stuff. And all of these theories, all of them were basically cooked up by these occult-obsessed, Egypt-obsessed, Kabbalah-obsessed French mystics and occultists and Freemasons. And they just start spreading it around each other.
Hmm.
And yeah, so Atea created his own deck. And it was the first deck that was created specifically for divination. And if you go and look at his deck, and you can get reproductions of it, and not expensive, it has Egyptian, the characters on the cards are dressed in Egyptian clothing. There's all these magical elements added, like the you know, what became the high priestess, which was originally the female pope, which is another cool tangent. She in Atea's deck, she's surrounded by like a skull, and she's standing in a magic circle and all this. So it begins to incorporate the idea that that the cards are ancient wisdom, and they've essentially, I mean, people still say this today. They say, well, this is ancient wisdom. And the way the ancient Egyptians and the Hebrews and the Kabbalists knew, the way they knew their wisdom would get down through the ages is they would hide it in something like playing cards. And people still say that, you know, people still, you know, absolutely say this is the truth, and it's absolutely not the truth. But they'll, you know, they'll yell at you till you're blue in the face about it. So now the cards get this air of occultism and mystery and associations with the Kabbalah and astrology and all this kind of stuff. And then the guy who really, really changed, really cemented this narrative was Eliphas Levy, who was a magician, a Kabbalist, a Rosicrucian, a Freemason, a hermetic mystic. This guy, he's responsible, I think, probably more than anyone else for the fact that the tarot exists today as a tool of divination and occult knowledge and things like that. So he was an interesting guy. I mean, he dropped out of, he was training to be a priest, and he was teaching, and he fell in love with a 16-year-old girl. And he said, you know, hell with the priesthood, man. I'm in love. The celibacy thing, no thank you. But then she dumped him, and so he continued his studies. He studied the Kabbalah, he took the tarot and he melded it with Kabbalah, with angelology, with ceremonial magic, with Rosicrucianism. I mean, he took all the fashionable occult stuff of his day and just mixed it all up together and created a system out of it. And so now there's this book that takes the tarot and matches it to the Kabbalah, to the Hebrew alphabet, to astrology, to all these to ceremonial magic, so all these pieces are falling into place, and then comes the biggie. Okay, the real reason that we're even talking about this today was because of the secret society that took Eliphas Levy's work and essentially brought it to the rest of the world. And you probably know who this is. This was the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 19th century, it was founded in 1888. Again, by some Freemasons, members of the SRIA, which is like the Rosicrucian body of Freemasonry. I'm actually a member of the North American version of this group. So these guys, the Golden Dawn, I mean, we can have a whole show on the Golden Dawn.
Oh, easily.
Fascinating. They essentially took Freemasonry and they, first of all, they invited women, which was really interesting. Cause it was all based on, I mean, you know, this is getting into the nitty gritty, but they allegedly found this cipher this manuscript in code. We're pretty certain that one of their SRI members actually wrote this up. But you know, if you're founding a mystical order, you have to have some kind of secret, you know, links back to, you know, the pre-flood era, stuff like that. So anyway, they, you know, they built this idea that the society was ancient, and but they admitted women because in the cipher manuscript it said sorores and not just fratres, so you know, sisters as well as brothers. So that set them apart. So they started in 1888, and like by the mid 1890s, they had about 100 members all over England. They had several lodges in England. They had one in Paris. And if you look at the membership of the Golden Dawn, everyone from William Butler Yeats, they had actresses. Florence Farr, who was an actress, Maud Gunn, the Irish revolutionary that Yeats was in love with. A little bit later, Aleister Crowley became a member, and I'm sure many of the people listening know all about Crowley and where he went from this. But this was like the cream of the crop of British society. Artists, intellectuals were really feeling this occult vibe sort of thing. So they were part of the Golden Dawn, and what the Golden Dawn did with tarot, they pretty much used tarot as kind of the root of their magical system. And just like Eliphas, they took some of Eliphas Levy's ideas, and some of the original members had met Eliphas Levy, and you know, so that's where some of these ideas came from. But they took the tarot and they mixed it up, just like he did with the Kabbalah, with astrology, but they brought in alchemy, magic. They created this incredibly ornate and complex, I mean, hurt your head complex system of magic. And all of that really, one of the first things you learned in the Golden Dawn was the tarot. And the correspondences, you know, between the tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree of life with alchemy, with astrology and all that stuff. So they really took the base that Levy had put together, and they made this enormous system out of it. And so that's really where the occult tarot really started to spread. And what happened, to jump ahead in time, the deck that most people associate with tarot, the Rider-Waite, or a lot of people call it the Rider-Waite Smith now, because Pamela Colpin Smith was the artist of that deck, but that's the deck you see everywhere, on TV, movies. If you go into a bookstore and you buy a tarot deck, it's the one that, you know, it's the one that jumps out, and everybody knows the images of it. Well, that was developed by members of the Golden Dawn. So that deck, which really created the tarot, you know, explosion in the early 20th century, I mean, we wouldn't be talking about this subject right now if it hadn't been for what the Golden Dawn did, and then what Arthur Edward Waite, who was a member of the Golden Dawn, as well as Pamela Coleman Smith, he sort of conceptualized the deck. She was the artist that made it. And you know, that's where at the time they were a little, they had left the Golden Dawn and formed their own order because Waite was kind of, he was getting a little freaked out by the magic stuff. He was more of a kind of an Orthodox Christian, so he wanted to get rid of the magic stuff. That's why in the Rider-Waite you see, you know, very explicit Christian imagery. Like the Ace of Cups is a chalice with a dove coming down to it with a host in its mouth. I mean, it's like explicitly, you know, Orthodox Christian, even though there's still some magical elements in it. Like you look at the Magician card, and he's a ceremonial magician in that deck. So it's this weird amalgamation of Christian, you know, kind of Orthodox Christian with some kind of heterodox Christianity. And some of the leftover ideas from the Golden Dawn. So that deck was published in 1909. So and it became the first non-continental deck. It was published in England, and all the other decks before that were European decks. But this was the first non-continental deck, and it just exploded in popularity, and that's why we have tarot today. That's why we have, you know, the tarot of the gummy bears and the tarot of the satanic kittens and the tarot, you know, we would not have any of that had it not been for the Golden Dawn and Waite, Arthur Edward Waite and Pamela Coleman Smith and the popularity of that deck. So,
and also for people who may not realize it, Levy is the one who has probably the most traditional image of Baphomet out there.
Yes, yes.
So when you see Baphomet, it's most of them are based off of Levy's interpretation of that.
Yes, and it was not at all, you know, meant to be satanic, you know, even though it's become associated with Satanism and, you know, darker strands of occultism or anything like that. You know, it's taken on those connotations, but for Levy, it didn't have those connotations at all. He's influential. I mean, how many satanic heavy metal bands have used that image and you know, just for shock value and stuff like that. But, I mean, that's like a super condensed history. I hope it's not too much thrown out there like that, but really if you traced the cards, it was a game. It was very Christian, explicitly Christian in its iconography until all these, you know, esotericists and occultists got their hands on it. And they based on a lot of misinformation that they believed because we didn't know any better back then. You know, they bought a lot of these ideas that it was ancient wisdom encoded in the cards, and they just propagated it. And like I said, you know, it's still that idea is still out there today. But I find, you know, I think real history is a lot more fascinating than bogus, you know, made up BS history. made up stuff is cool too. And, you know, I mean, when it comes to occultism and religion and spiritual, everything's kind of made up anyway. I don't have any problem with people using the cards for, applying the Kabbalah to the cards, or applying Egyptian ideas or creating a tarot of Wicca, you know, tarot of the witches and things like that. That's great. I mean, it's a living thing it is. And it's become this, you know, it's become this so many different forms of symbolism and has been added to it. But I think it's important that you know the history, because then you're not repeating these myths, and it allows you to understand where all these ideas came from. And, for me, I got deeply into the Golden Dawn system of magic. And this was my eureka moment with tarot. I was busting my head, memorizing, like, the Golden Dawn system, each of the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life has a card associated with it. And but each path between the cards has a, I mean, between the spheres on the Tree of Life has a card associated with it too. And each card has an, you know, a decan of astrology related to it and alchemical significance and all this stuff. And I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around all this. And one day I just said, why am I doing this? You know, it's a fine system. It's a workable system. It's a useful system. It's interesting, but it was made up, you know, by Mathers and his, the rest of his crew. And you know, it was the, before that it was made up by Levy, and before that Court de Gebelin. And why am I, you know, why don't I just start with where these cards really came from? So I went back and, you know, I ditched the whole Golden Dawn system, you know, even though I'd invested, you know, a lot, you know, of time and energy and learning this system and learning how to work this system and how it all fit together. And I just ditched it. I said, I'm going to go back and look and start with the oldest decks because you can find them, you know, reasonably priced, most of them, and just start working with the older decks. And that was an enormous change for me. Like everything just started to click after that. The more I learned about the history, the more I worked with the older decks, especially the Marseille tarot, which is like 17th century French tarot, because that's where the pattern that we have now in the decks really kind of fell into place. So I consider that like the real first, you know, modern sort of tarot deck. And I read Alejandro Jodorowsky's book, The Way of Tarot, The Spiritual Teacher in the Cards. And it was an enormous eye-opener for me. And I started working with those older decks, and man, they really started talking to me. Mm-hmm. And I can't even look at the Rider-Waite-Smith anymore. It's because I think what happened is these older decks had like sort of an iconic purity. And when the Golden Dawn got a hold of them, and then when Crowley, I should mention also the Thoth deck, which is enormously popular. Thoth, yeah. I mean, there's different ways of pronouncing it. You know, I default to Thoth, but yes, it's probably supposed to be the Thoth. But I've heard scholars say, you know, Thoth, not yeah. related to the deck. So I'm sure people will correct me if I'm wrong, and that's okay. But his deck is also enormously influential, and you want to talk about a deep symbolic significance.
Yeah.
You know, based on Thelema, you know, essentially his religion, and the teachings of the OTO, that's another brain buster of a system. Those cards work. I mean, I've used them.
That's what I use.
It's a great deck. It's powerful. Sometimes it's a little sharp is what I like to call it. And what it tells you, it has its very own personality. I love the art. The art is just powerful and deeply yeah. resonant, but I think you can use that deck without knowing anything about Crowley or Thelema. You can just sit down and use it, and it's a very good deck. I still pull it out once in a while, but once I started using these older decks, man, the power of the readings, the insights I was getting out of them, really just changed my whole way of thinking about the tarot. And I look at some of these kind of fanciful decks that have real sort of comic booky looking, you know, fantasy illustrations, and I can't even touch them. they work for a lot of people. A lot of people love these sort of fantasy style decks. I can't even, like, it's, I can't stomach. I can't stomach them. And it, because after the Golden Dawn and Atea, people started adding all this esoteric stuff. And the biggest problem I have, and I still sometimes teach the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, but the biggest problem I have is people will get this, get the card and start looking at it and go, well, the magician has, you know, there's a red flower here, or the fool. What's this thing on the fool's jacket? Why is he carrying a white flower? And they just get bogged down in the minutia, I call it esoteric cruft. It's like this junk that's just been stuck into the images, and it keeps them from being able to read. Whereas it's kind of paradoxical, but the simpler the art, I've found at least, and I think a lot of the people I've taught agree, is the simpler the iconography, the simpler the art, there's actually more you can pull out of it, the more it can speak to you, than these decks with all these, you know, pentagrams and, you know, alchemical symbols and all this stuff just like stuck in there. I think that's more of a distraction, at least for me. You know, this tarot is a very personal thing, but I teach people to read in a very, very simple style. And in my classes, I teach people how to read in 6 hours. We do this. I used to call it a tarot boot camp. In 6 hours, I teach them the history, but then I teach them how a way to read with the cards that they can then actually leave that class and start reading for people. And one of the things I say is don't read that damn little white book that comes in every pack of tarot cards. Just stick it in a drawer. You can look at it later. You want to just take those cards. And again, if you know the history, you'll know what the major cards are. You know, you'll know that the high priest was actually the pope. You know, you'll know the high priestess was actually the female pope. So you kind of know the basic gist of these cards. You know that, like, you'll understand more if you know the history. So then you can, you know, you can just look at those major cards and just start getting to know the cards. Put the cards out. I also teach people you can read these older decks. A lot of them don't have scenes on every card, like the Rider-Waite-Smith, and that freaks people out. They're like, you know, like the Two of Coins has two coins on it. Mm-hmm. How the hell am I supposed to read that? Well, you can. But if you want to work with these older decks, and I really encourage people to try it, just start with the major cards. Their readers in Europe, in particular, where if you go to get a reading, they'll just pull out those major cards and give you an incredible reading with just 22 cards. You don't need the whole 78 cards of the deck. And a lot of them just put the pip cards, as they're called. They put the ones with just, you know, three swords on them, or whatever. They just put that to the side and read with the majors. And I read for people most of the time only with the majors, because I use these older decks. So, you know, I encourage people just get a you know, get one of these older decks. You know, a Marseille tarot. They're becoming extremely popular in the tarot community. And they're just really simple art. Just sit down, start working with those 22 cards, start asking questions, start putting a few cards down. And that's the other thing that I kind of rebel against the traditional way tarot is taught. Is like, I hate the Celtic cross
spread. Yeah, me too.
I can't stand it. And I've seen so many people lose their minds laying out that many cards when they have a question, and, oh, well, this covers me, and this is the past, and this is this, and this is that. And it short circuits the ability to read the cards. And reading the cards is like reading a comic book or something. They're pictures. You ask a question, and you put, I sometimes do an hour reading, just putting down three or four cards for someone. When I read for myself, I'll put one, two, or three cards down. And it's amazing what you can get out of that. So don't feel like you need to learn the Celtic cross. You need to learn, I mean, there are books. There are books with hundreds of pages of different spreads, you know.
Yeah.
What should you have for breakfast spread? You know, should I divorce this guy and marry the other guy spread? Or yeah, and it's silly to me. It works for a lot of people, and if you do it and you like it, that's great.
So
I think, yeah, go ahead.
The question is, why does it work?
Yeah, well, man, I mean, that's the $64,000 question. You know, I have theories on that, as you might imagine. You know, I think any divination system kind of works in the same way. And that's you take a selected number of symbols. You know, if it's runes, you've got, you know, X number of runes. If you've got the I Ching, you have yarrow sticks, or you use pennies or something like that. But you've got the 64 hexagrams to work with in the I Ching. Right. In the tarot, you either use your 22 majors or your 78 full deck. So you have this random mix of potent imagery. I think that's why the tarot is such an effective divination tool. It's really, I mean, the imagery is just striking. You know, you put down the devil card, and, you know, even though I've done, you know, you can still have a visceral reaction to these cards. The imagery is just, it's archetypal in a lot of ways. Often it's beautifully done. There is, you know, there's heady symbolism involved. These are images that just speak to us. You know, if I brought in some 7-year-old kids and told them to tell stories with the tarot, they could do it. It's potent, archetypal, really resonant imagery. So you take all this imagery and you mix it all up, you randomize it, just like you randomize your coin flips in the I Ching, or you draw your runes, or geomancy, you know, you stick sticks in the dirt and look at the patterns. Whatever the divination system, you're taking a set of symbols and you're randomizing them, and you're asking a question, or you're trying to get insight into something, and you take these random symbols and you put them out. And if you're a psychologically minded person, you'll say, well, you're looking through your consciousness, you're reacting subconsciously, you're noting patterns, and you're creating a story out of these random images in front of you. And if you're a psychologically minded person, you're not a spiritual person, that right there, so there are psychologists who use the tarot strictly in a psychological sense to have people work with their subconscious and their conscious ideas and stories and tell their stories and get insights. So you can look at it that way, and it's perfectly effective that way. I tend to think there's an element of synchronicity that when you attempt to utilize synchronicity or randomness with intention, when you take random symbols and mix them up and really try to ask a question or get insight into something, it works. And I'm not 100% sure how that works, but it does work. And when I teach people, when I teach these classes, and I teach the history, and then I teach, you know, my sort of style of reading, and I go, okay, grab the person next to you and read for that person. And they're intimidated. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I can't do this. I've never done this before. I'm like, just sit down, let the person ask a question, lay out some cards, and read like I just told you how to do it, which is really simple, which is like looking at the images and making stories out of them. And they are shocked. Like they light up when they see that it's working, and it just works. And you know, it's there are all kinds of, you know, theories of divination. Jungian thinkers have written on it, so you can look at it from a Jungian synchronicity approach. People talk about spirit guides working through the cards. I mean, there's so many ways to look at, to theorize about why this works. But the important thing to me is just that it works. And I can sit down with someone I've never met, and they ask me a question, and I put down some cards, and a few minutes later, they're just nodding. You know, this, and this isn't the Barnum effect, where I'm telling them, oh, you know, you sometimes like to be alone, but sometimes you like to be around other people. And they go, oh, yeah, that's great. Oh, my God, you're amazing. I mean, it gets deep, and it hits at things that, you know, there's no possible way I would have had any idea. And also, but the interesting thing about a tarot reading is that it's an interplay of the reader and the person asking the question, the querent or the sitter, they're sometimes called. So it's kind of like a dance. And it's like a mutual telling of a story. Because if I'm reading for someone, I might say, well, this might indicate, you know, the Empress, this could be your mother, or this could be, you know, this could mean you as a mother, something like that. And then we go on to the next card, the Fool. Well, this, you know, the Fool, blah, blah, blah. So I'm just, you know, I'm riffing on what the cards are saying to me, but I'm also looking at, you know, is the Empress looking at the Fool? Is the Fool walking away from the Empress? So I'm just, you know, saying what I'm seeing, and it just, you know, they feed back to me what they're seeing, or they respond to what I'm saying. So we're kind of co-creating this reading. I don't believe that anyone who reads tarot sits down, looks at the cards, and looks at the other person and says, you know, you're gonna break your leg next week. Your wife's gonna lose her job. You know, one of your kids is out, you know, doing heroin with his butt. You know, I mean, that's just not the way a reading works. The reading is really like a dance between two people. And a lot of times when I'm reading someone, the person I'm reading for will look over and go, well, that, you know, that kind of reminds me of my brother or something. And then that pushes it farther along. But at the same time, sometimes things just come up. And I do believe that people maybe who are a little more, you know, psychically attuned or something like that can be better readers. You know, they can pick up on things at a deeper level or a little stronger in their, you know, their hits, what they get right about the cards, things like that. But I completely believe, because I've watched it, is that anyone can sit down and do this. And there have been people who, you know, they come to my class and like, I can't, this is fascinating, but I can't do it. And I say, well, sit down next, read for that person next to you. And inevitably they can do it. And it might not be, you know, an astounding reading, but I've never had someone say, wow, that completely didn't work and we didn't connect and nothing happened. So I think it's something anyone can do. Yeah. Yeah. And the more you do it, the better you get, like anything, like riding a bicycle or playing a sport. The more you do it, the more associations with the cards you develop. And, you know, just the bigger your vocabulary for the cards and things you associate them with gets. And so you learn from experience, and that experience makes you a better reader. But anyone can sit down and do it. I completely believe that because I've seen it happen over and over and over again.
All right. Now, at one point you were working on a book about this.
Yeah. Before I got derailed by another project that kind of swept up all my time. And I'm still going to do this. I was working on a book about working specifically with pre-20th century tarots. Mm. So the cards that I like, the cards that I collect, because there's such a booming interest in them. I think as people are a little tired of the, you know, the tarot of the Wiccan kiddies and, you know, and these just kind of kooky, you know, cartoon, silly tarots, right. People are kind of looking to get back at some of the older decks and the older ways of reading, similar to, you know, people involved in magic, you know, trying to go back to like some of the earliest texts, the Greek, you know, magical texts and things like that, or the grimoires, et cetera. So there's, you know, there's this interest in history because there is so much history available to us now. So we can take some of these older decks and do really interesting things with them. Like there's a deck called the Minkiate that has the zodiacal signs. So it has all the and the planets and things like that. So I say to people, why go through these convoluted systems to try to learn? Oh, well, the sun card is actually related to Virgo. These complicated systems, when you can get a Minkiate deck and just have the zodiac and the cards, right. Or have the planets and things like that. So again, there's just this really, really booming interest in these older decks. And what I'm trying, when I go on shows like this, when I talk, when I teach in my classes, I really encourage people, get some of these older decks and learn their history and try working with them and see the difference, because I think there really is a big difference.
All right. So where can people find more on you?
Me? Yeah. MichaelMHughes.com. I have a tarot site, but it's kind of defunct. I'm rolling that into my new website. I also am planning, if I can take care of my other book requirements and things like that, I'm planning on putting my tarot class online.
Nice.
Because so many people have asked if they could take it, but they're not local to Baltimore and DC, where I usually teach. And people are saying, please put your class online. So I'm finally going to get this 6-hour intensive class, that covers all the history again, the way I teach people to read, the kind of open-ended style of reading, and gets them going reading, and also intro to some of the older decks and things like that. So I love talking about the stuff, as you can tell, if I haven't bored everybody to tears at this point, but it's a fascinating subject. And if anyone has questions, just please go to my website. I can point you to some great resources. I have a list of some of the decks. Hey, I hear a kitty back there.
Yes.
But there is a deck of the kitty. If you like cat decks, there's tarot cat decks. So maybe your cat will want to take a look at those. But I have lists of some really the better decks, the better books, authors. Like I said, Alejandro Jodorowsky. His book, The Way of Tarot, is essential. Gareth Knight, who's an occultist, also one of my favorite writers on tarot. Go to my website, and there's lots of stuff there that can take you further along your studies.
Cool. Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, man. It was a lot of fun, as always. Thanks for having me on.
All right. As I said, there'll be an extra segment for Patreons. I think it's about a half an hour long, if I remember right, where we talk more about the tarot and divination in general. And, of course, you can become a patron at wheredidtheroadgo.com. To take you out tonight, we're going to hear Eliza Rickman, Pretty Little Head, one of my favorites. See you next time.
hero, wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mouth, pretty little head. But where's your mother? Fall down dead. Dirty mouth, pretty little head. Wish you were here, wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mouth, pretty little head.
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.